Thank you, Ron. Thank you, buddy. We'll talk later.
Yes, we will.
Good morning, folks. Yeah. Just working, just on that, Bob. Yeah. It's great to see you. I'm gracious. You're a frisky looking bunch out here this morning. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And, I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And, my sobriety date's Groundhog Day of 57. And so, shoot, man, I'm lucky to be breathing. Never mind. Never mind being in Lake Milton, Ohio. I am just delighted to be here. I got my first question in the Ask It basket, and I didn't write it. I can't say it the way the writer would have said it, but it'd be, "Hello, Tom. I do hope you enjoyed your Scotland experience. Patrick and George from Dundee, Scotland." I don't know if everybody's aware or not, but this is now an international workshop. And I'd like for you to meet those guys. This is Patrick. Stand up now. Don't be bashful. Scottish people are not bashful. Patrick has on the Irish green shirt, and George is properly Dundee. You talk about, yeah, isn't that, what does that say, George? Good what?
Scotland.
Oh, my God. I should have known. I didn't need to ask. It was really ironic that these guys came over last week for the, they went to the Florida State Convention. And while they were at the Florida State Convention, I was at a convention in Scotland at just a few miles from where they live. So that was really reciprocal trade in action, I think, that was going on. But I was just delighted to see them. I sponsored a guy from Dundee for many years. And so it was sort of a pilgrimage, but we went to that town. That was just great. The other folks are Bill and Nora from Stratford. Not Stratford-on-Avon, but from Stratford, Ontario. You guys are probably not unknown, but stand anyway. This is our Canadian delegation. Yeah. That's also reciprocity, because a lot of us were in your country back in July. And so it's great to have you guys here. And welcome to everybody. What we do this morning is normally at a workshop, I dress down a little bit, because if you put work in it, that, to me, takes the ceremony out. Now it's time for grunting and groaning and sweating and agonizing and stuff. So I don't fly the flag. In fact, I don't wear the coat very long. But it's sort of new, and I'd like for you to see it. And I'll shed that dude pretty quick. But it is a real pleasure to be here. You met Kent last night, and you'll meet Wallace tonight. I've alerted them to be on standby, because who knows, you know, that old guy might need a little help sometimes. So I've alerted both of them to be ready to participate. If I start to wimp out on anything, if you ask a tough question, I'll pull those boys into action now. And I appreciate their willingness to do that. Let me tell you, they gave a little bit of a rundown on how we'd function. And I don't ever like to start out a talk with any play down about inability to do it and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's a given. But I like to approach things like a workshop. I'm not a canned production guy. You know, I'm not somebody that has a file with a folder for every kind of thing I want to do. I have an office at my house. My wife doesn't call it an office. She calls it a junk room. But I think it's just perfectly organized. And I got everything in the known world. So when I'm going to prepare, I don't grab a folder. I just grab some stuff, you know. And so I sorted it out down in the motel. But I'm somebody who likes to communicate in the here and now. I'm not somebody who likes to decide what I'm going to say to a group in Ohio that I haven't even met yet. And so, to me, that's not communication. So it's a lot easier if you can it, and you know, you don't have to think about it. You just sort of present it. It's a lot easier. But I don't envy anybody that can do that, because I really believe that communication is what it's about. And I do like the interaction things Bob was referring to. And so please feel free at any time to just step up to the mic. But he said it well. I couldn't say it any better, that's for sure. Don't do it from where you sit. Just go to the mic, because we want to record you in case we have to bring charges or anything. We got the evidence in place. And that's a promise. I'm getting out of this, dude. There's a time that would have been a very dangerous invitation, I think. So here the basic thing I've got in mind, I've had it in mind for probably 30 minutes. So what I'd like to do is that we're a strange breed. It's hard for us to listen to somebody unless they do a little drinking first. If somebody just starts talking with us with a bunch of philosophy and education and information, I don't think I've ever seen a crowd that would stonewall somebody quicker than us. I mean, we're usually courteous and we'll sit there and act like we're listening. But ain't nothing happening. That's why we call it qualifying, you know. Now I'll work in qualifying all through here. But I like to start out, rather than trying to introduce notions about emotional sobriety and then explaining that and doing problem solving and all that stuff, I'm suspicious of that kind of approach. I don't like that kind of approach. What I like to do is start out with what are we talking about when we talk about things that are disruptive or unproductive in having emotional sobriety. And so I'd like to kind of take off in that direction. Before I do, let me do one other thing. I'm a fortunate man in that I had the privilege of meeting Bill Wilson. That's one of the few fringe benefits of being old, is that I got to meet our founder. And I value that experience a great deal. And I found him to be one of the most visionary, most brilliant, most articulate people I've ever seen in my life. He was a guy that really had his act together, and he did a lot of good work. And this piece that everybody had in their envelope on emotional sobriety is a good piece. And I'm not going to dissect it, but I want to draw your attention to one thing at the very bottom of it, where he said this, and I'll read it out loud and slow for our Scottish friends. I was over there, the last time I spoke to a group over there, I said, I got to get out of here. I'm beginning to understand you people. It took 10 days to get to understand. And so I'll speak slowly. Here's what Bill said. Of course, I haven't offered you a really new idea. Only a gimmick that has started to unlock several of my own hexes at depth. Nowadays, my brain no longer races compulsively in either elation, grandiosity, or depression. I've been given a quiet place in bright sunshine. And I think that's an important end, and it's almost a disclaimer in a way that And say this just as it's my belief, not just opinion, but it's my belief. I believe that our set of principles embodied in 12 steps are more than adequate for the overwhelming majority of people who come into Alcoholics Anonymous. The overwhelming majority of us seem to be able to recover very, very nicely, very strongly, very adequately with the steps alone. Now there are some who have disabilities or handicaps or whatever that go beyond the capability. There are some people who have genuine disabilities that have to be addressed. And I personally think it's awfully important to be willing and prepared to refer that person to the right source if they have problems that exceed our capabilities. And in sponsorship, I think that's one of the real responsibilities, is know when I'm getting in water deeper than I can handle. And so when we're talking about something like, like this subject of emotional sobriety, I really like to look at that in the context of first, that are the steps adequate to give me exactly what I need? Now, I'm one who so far has been able to get what he needs out of the steps, so I'm a little biased in that direction. And I'm not quarreling with Bill, but he had the kind of mind that was just active. You know, he was the kind of guy that was always probing a new horizon. And I think till the day he died, he had a visionary quality about him. And so I look at this as just a thing. What it basically says when he gets through with all the visiting is there's nothing that more effectively treats us than actively working with other people and not studying ourselves. And so anyway, with that little bit of an introduction, let me kind of take off with, now these are really well thought out things. It probably took me 20 minutes to write them. But you know, when I do something quickly, it tends to be my best work. If I labor over it, I get it so screwed up I can't even read it. Because when I start throwing thoughts out, what I'll do is start censoring and editing. The more I think about it, the more complex I make it. And almost always, after about 2 hours of visiting outer space, I would go right back to where I started. And so my first idea is usually the best it gets. So even though this is a crude-looking piece of work, I don't apologize for it. Probably wouldn't be smarter if I spent a month doing it. What I did was just try to think about what are some things that interfere with good, sound, emotional sobriety, recovery. What are things that interfere with that? And some of these you'll recognize, some of them you probably will identify with. And not many of them, it's only 27. And I ran out of time. I could have listed some more. I won't elaborate too much on any of them because that would take till Sunday afternoon. And so I won't get into that too deeply at this point. One, expectations. And I put that one high on the list because I think that is a genuinely troubling kind of quality that in our society, and certainly in our society of AA, and so much so that I've gotten to a point that I don't put expectations on anybody for anything to the best of my ability. And I think I do pretty well at that. I don't put expectations. Anytime I put expectations on people, I will be disappointed. Because humans are humans. We're fallible. And we're going to disappoint. We're not going to perform the way somebody put expectations on us to do. So I don't put expectations. And by doing that, I protect myself from a very disruptive thing. When I put expectations on somebody, what I do is give them free access to my mind. They own my mind. And I'm jealous about who owns my mind. So I don't want somebody living in my head. And so if I put expectations and I wind up getting thwarted or frustrated in it, I'm going to tend to be a little bit disenchanted with that whole business. So expectations is a great creator of emotional turmoil, I guess you could call it. Old ideas. In 65, I went up to Canada. I was brave enough to go up to my first international. And there was a bad drunk that came in that I was working with some from the state of Michigan. We really are a kind of geographically mixed bunch. This guy came in. He was all excited. He was a real knucklehead anyway. But he was real excited. He said, "Come on out to the car, man. I got to show you something." And I said, "Well, All right, let's go. So I went in, he opened the trunk. Somebody had just invented near beer. I said, tell me what that is. So he explained to me about its delightful qualities and that it was totally non-alcoholic. Didn't read the label very well, but that it was totally non-alcoholic. But what he had was a case of old ideas. It was a case of old ideas. And old ideas have got to be upsetting to my emotional sobriety. And old ideas come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. You ever listen to folks, it'll tend to be folks in their first, say, 5 years and less of sobriety, who don't know quite what to do with themselves socially. You're kind of lost. You can't hang out with the old crowd. Can't go back to the old haunts. And then sometimes we'll get just agitated enough that they'll want to go to a place that has dancing, not to drink, of course, but to dance. Well, that's called an old idea. When I find my comfort and my joys and satisfaction in my old hangouts, that's an old idea. And as long as I'm pursuing that, I'm not going to have a whole lot of peace, I don't think. So old ideas, those things that sort of hang on, that still have some attractiveness to it, that we romance, and old ideas. Limited or unclear commitments. Limited or unclear commitments. I believe that one of the most important things I do in Alcoholics Anonymous is make real commitments. And a commitment means that I'm going to do what that commitment says I'll do. My good friend Jack had to leave this morning because he had a commitment that he had made. Though you could say it wasn't a direct AA thing. It had to do with taking care of an autistic child. He tried everything under the sun to find a way to do, to be able to stay with us, but he had a commitment that he couldn't get satisfied another way, and so he left. With dignity and honor. See what I'm talking about? You know, selfishly he wanted to hang out with us. Selfishly he wanted to be here with us and explore something, but he honored a commitment. Better man for it. Commitments are awfully important. That commitments that are lightly made are easily broken. Yeah. I heard somebody inviting a speaker one time to come somewhere and speak. And the speaker said, that date's open, but I don't know for sure and I can't guarantee you that I'll be there because something else might come up. I guarantee you, my eraser would have been in action very quickly. And I would have withdrawn that invitation. Because, my God, what is that? A commitment are things that I am absolutely going to do. Like my home group, for example. My home group is a commitment. It's not under the heading of nice to do. And it's not negotiable. That's something I do. I have a prison commitment that I do every Wednesday night. Unless I've got an overriding service thing, same with my home roof, I've got an overriding service thing that I really feel like is more valuable that night and I'm not abandoning a commitment, then I'll do something. But otherwise, those are commitments. And they really do a lot to steady my life. I'm not a meeting guy. I mean, I don't have a lot of time on my hands to just sort of fish around for meetings. Most of the things I do are planful and they're committed. But commitments do a great deal to settle me in, to give me a strong foundation. If you ask me what my commitments are, I just told you. I've got two nights at my home group, one at my prison commitment. Everything else I do is negotiable until I make a commitment. Like coming to Milton, Lake Milton, Ohio. That was negotiable before we got it on the book. But when it's on the book, then it's not negotiable. How good. She was talking about Dave Denny a little earlier. She said, sometimes those commitments will get you in a little bit of a hot water. I'd made a commitment to be in Chicago for the Illinois State Convention. And I loved it, but those folks, it wouldn't matter if I hated them. It was a commitment. I'd go anyway. Well, it's a strange thing. People don't always mean the same thing by the same words. First weekend, it may have a totally different meaning to you than it does me. Well, we didn't discuss that when we made the commitment in Chicago. The guy said, first weekend. Well, to him, the first weekend meant Saturday was the weekend. Well, I always mean Friday. Well, Dave Denny called, and I made a commitment to be in Tampa on what he perceived to be the first weekend. Turned out, it was the same weekend. Well, that's a dilemma. Yeah, for somebody that wants to honor commitments, that's a dilemma. And so what I have to do when I do something like that is go back to what did you put down first? Now let me tell you what was a real crisis about that. The conference we were going to do in Tampa was my sponsorship line. We were the whole conference. My sponsorship line. My sponsor from Canada was coming down. Me, one guy from me. We would conference. Man, that's a once in a lifetime opportunity. And I looked at that book and Chicago was first. And I called Dave down in Florida and I said, buddy, I hate to tell you, but I'm not going to be able to come. And he about had a duck fit. Now, he's a nice man. He really was a nice guy. But he wasn't that day. He said, you got to come now. You just said you come. You just got to come. Because the whole thing collapses. You take out one domino to fall. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but I can't do it. I said, I'm speaking Saturday night up there. If I get out of there on Saturday, there's no plane coming out of there on Saturday night. Only one day left anyway. And he said, well, that's not right. He said, we go through Monday. Well, my God, isn't it amazing? You know, those things that you have the most dilemma about was no problem. No problem. He said, shoot, man, I'll get on down here and we'll do it. So where's that? Of course, they packed me up for 2 days down there. But commitments are important. And if I don't honor that, if I get frivolous about that, I'll pay a price because it will impact my personal integrity. It will impact how I function as a member, as the kind of member I want. It will impact my emotional sobriety. Because those are actions that are committed to do. And if I don't do them, I pay a price for them. Dishonesty. Absolutely. Eat my lunch. And even if it's just an insinuated, I've almost quit lying. I mean, I don't lie now unless it's absolutely necessary. I'm not going to tell somebody they got an ugly baby. And no, they're all beautiful. But sometimes I will agree with somebody who thinks something that ain't right. And I won't take the time to straighten it out. And I say, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, well, that bothers me. Because if I allow somebody else to lie on my behalf, and I agree, I'm part of it. So dishonesty, yeah, it doesn't go away. You know, that thing's going to eat on me and eat on me. And lo and behold, I'm looking for something called emotional sobriety. Not practicing principles. I think Kent said it awfully well last night. That he said a lot of stuff awfully well last night. But he was talking about the principles don't mean much if I do them in the walls. It's what I do with them outside the walls. What I do in my life. You know, what is it I do to practice these principles? And if I don't practice them on the highway, I don't have any. I've just got sort of a part-time application. And so those principles, if I don't practice those principles, if what you see is not what I say I am, goodbye, emotional sobriety. Goodbye. Because I am totally lacking integrity if I do that. So those not practicing the principles, and that means everywhere. It means in I was trying to get out of Glasgow the other day, and I thought we had some zoos of airports. We do. But my God, they told me to be there 3 hours early. I said, for what? I saw when I got there. Good. I needed a little more time. Yeah. But even then, you know, I had a good time going through that. I mean, I didn't enjoy the 3 hour wait, but I'll guarantee you we had a good time. There was one old security boy standing there. He looked like a statue, you know, just standing there. So I went over and just messed with him a little bit. And the first thing you know, he yucking it up, you know. And so, you know, instead of being tense and all this kind of junk, you know, here were just some human beings, and he had a worse place than me. He wasn't going nowhere. He just staying there. But, you know, to me, that's what practice and the principles are about. It's about sort of being the kind of guy I want to be where I am. Resentment. No, none of us ever had any problem with that, but the best definition I've ever heard of resentment in my life is it's an irritation that turns inward and gets infected. And oh boy, isn't it amazing how the least little thing that turns in, if I don't deal with it, just grows. It just grows. And then some minor nothing issue becomes tantamount to the Third World War. You know what I mean? And so anyway, those things, when I'm carrying around resentment, my peace of mind, my emotional sobriety, it's being owned by somebody. Being owned. I tell you, the dumbest, taught me a lesson early on. First time I ever tried to deal with a resentment, the way it was a suggestion program, had a guy that I was in the same group with. We're nearly always the same meeting. And I thought that guy's only purpose for coming to AA was to argue with me. I was just irritated about that, you know. And never did talk with him. So went on a few months, and I just got so I just couldn't stand that guy. He was on my mind all the time. And I said, heck, I'm going to try some of this stuff. So went up to him, told him, I said, look, we need to talk and see if we can settle this thing. He didn't know what I was talking about. Had no clue what I was talking about. I've been fighting for 3 or 4 months by myself. You know? And felt like the village idiot. I felt my God. Yeah, but that's what resentment does. It doesn't have to make sense. It just has to be something that I've got feeling about. And that sucker will grow. Yeah. Feeling beleaguered. Feeling beleaguered. Yeah. It's like guys on the committee. You know, that you were right when you were talking about the folk on a committee for a conference are under a lot of heat, under a lot of pressure. Now, it's self-imposed, but that's the good part of it. But it's still easy to feel like, man, you got the whole world whirling around, and you got to get stuff done, do it now. Yeah, I'm involved at one conference in North Carolina I'm heavily involved in, and I've got a way to evaluate whether I've done a good job of what I'm doing in putting the conference together. I always evaluate it by how busy I am at the conference and whether I've got a headache or not. And I can absolutely do my performance appraisal by those two factors. Yeah, is my head hurting and how busy am I? And if I've done a good job, that chaos slows down a little. Yeah. But if it does not, yeah, I'm like a one-armed paper hanger. Overcommitted, which sounds that way. Sounds a little like the same thing. But overcommitted means it's self-imposed, you know, that I'm not thoughtful about what I'm doing and I'm agreeing to stuff. Just like that overcommitted with Chicago and Tampa. That was a little bit of that was just dumb. No, that wasn't bad judgment. That was just dumb. But being overcommitted that I've got more to do than I can get done. And that'll take it away. Now, I don't mind telling you that I teeter on the brink of that often, because I've got a heart to serve. That's my purpose in life, as I want to be of service in this fellowship, to give back at least as much as I can what's been given me. And for that reason, I've developed a principle, an ethic, that I don't say no. And when you don't say no, you're going to be awfully busy. And I never say no on the basis of personal comfort or convenience. You know, not for those kinds of reasons. I say no lots of times because I've got something else going on. I've got another commitment. And so, but that whole business of getting overcommitted, all I have to do is take a look at my house and where I live and see how overcommitted I might be. I've got a wife, whether she knows it or not. What I have to keep in mind is every time I make a commitment, I also involve her in it, because she's part of it. And every time I leave on a weekend, I leave her with every ounce of responsibility. So there are all kinds of ways that overcommitment can come in, and they are really troubling kind of things. Trying to be all things to all people. Trying to be all things to all people. I read a thing a while back that really, you ever just read something that just kind of makes your ears burn a little? When you read it, you just say, uh-oh. And it was a simple little old quote said, "People respond to me as I teach them to do. People respond to me as I teach them to do." See, I'm the kind of guy with the kind of drive I have. What I teach people is, if there's something that's got to be done, don't worry about it. Just wait a little while. Old Tom will take care of that. Yeah. That's what I teach people. And people understand that. Yes, but I can't blame people for using me. What I teach people is that's what I do. So that trying to be all things, trying to respond to every issue in mind, I have to count myself sometimes and make sure that I'm not taking on more than is appropriate, that I'm not letting my zeal push other people out of the opportunity to be of service. And that's a biggie, because a guy like me can interfere with service involvement as much as enhance it. And so it's the principle that can do away with this whole business about the sense of wholeness and emotional sobriety. Activity versus action. Activity versus action is thanks, Bob. I think that's probably, it may be pretty well understood. Both are worthwhile things. I think my first few years, maybe the first 5 years or first 50, something like that. Seriously, about the first 5 years, I was incredibly active. Now, I'm active now, but I was incredibly active. We sometimes bemoan the fact that we're not getting 12 steps called. I've had three at the same time. You know, never mind the same day. I've had three at the same time. And you get three crazy drunks in the car trying to get them under some kind of control, that will really keep you busy. And so I was frantically active. I was trying to build AA in a town, you know, that was just dead in a doornail. In retrospect, when I look back at that was valuable. That activity was valuable, because what it did was protect me from myself. And I would have been dangerous left unattended. So that gave me that real, real protection of being strongly involved in things that had meaning, and it gave me a sense of usefulness and purpose. They were extremely useful, but it would have been pretty bad had I just continued to do that forever. And so it's I'll give you one example of that and then just mention about action. I'll tell you one of the downsides of something like that. When I was in that city and we were trying to get AA going there, I was a very, very, very active man. And I sponsored about everybody in town. And interesting thing happened. I stayed in that town 2 years. And we got a good group going. Stayed there 2 years, but when I moved away, everybody I sponsored but one got drunk. Now, that'll rattle your cage. That'll rattle your cage. And I thought, my God, what's going on? And what I realized is that, you know, if you had gone to any one of those people and said, who is the best sponsor in the known world? Guarantee you it would have been Tom I. Well, my sponsorship at that time was literally, get in the car. We're going somewhere. We were taking convoys of people to go and do missionary work in other towns and all, God knows what all. And so, you know, what they were doing were just sort of like those sheep, follow folk over there. They got more sheep in Scotland than people. That, I was amazed at that. Well, anyway, that's a whole other story. That is something else. I'm going to avoid that. But you see what I'm talking about? You know, I was a charismatic leader. You know, I was like the Pied Piper. You just, come on, guys, go with me. Don't worry about where we're going. Just get in the car. Let's go. Well, that's wonderful as long as you're there to herd the sheep. But in reality, I was doing a great disservice to those people. Rather than taking the time to help them understand the solution, not only would they have said I was the best sponsor in the world, if they'd have said, what's the solution? He says, do what Tom says. Well, that's great. But it's an awfully limited way to do it, isn't it? And so that's activity, you know, of just frantically rushing from one thing to another. Action's a little different. An action, like doing the steps, is an action. That's an action where we're taking a concrete, specific action that's got a real purpose involved in it. A home group is an action. Making 90 meetings in 90 days is activity. There's a different quality to that. An action is something that anchors me into a solid affiliation so that I'm taking a stand, I belong somewhere. And I start to do purposeful things rather than just staying busy. And so big difference that to the untrained eye, they don't look that different. But the difference is in the solidity and what it produces in terms of healthy recovery and responsible kinds of actions in the program. Me versus we thinking. Me versus we thinking. That, you know, some of that certainly is in place. I mean, this is a selfish program. We'll talk a little more about this one later on, but me versus we is where I'm thinking only in terms of me and what I get. I tell you, it's been an awful lot of years since I've gone to a meeting and had any thought whatsoever about what I needed. I mean, many, many years. I don't do that in meetings. What I go to meetings for is to contribute and to be a part of it, to sit in the fellowship. It's not, it becomes a we thing. So that when I go to a meeting, I've got many functions and what I need is rarely on the agenda. So, and we'll visit that one some more a little bit later on. Carrying the world on my shoulders. It's a heavy thing. Heavy thing. Using people. If I take advantage of somebody, if I start using people, I'm going to pay a price for that. Yeah. Of not thinking in terms of their welfare, but thinking in terms of just their usefulness to me, if something I want to get done. self-centeredness. It really relates to what I was just talking about. If all I'm thinking about is me and mine. If you think about, well, I'll just say this, and then we will come back on this one as well. But you know, a lot of times in our meetings, as opposed to a group, in a meeting, the agenda is almost always going to be about me and my recovery. Rarely gets beyond that into broader issues of broader concern. They'll tend to be pretty much narrowly focused on me and my recovery. Now that's a great thing, but by itself, it bears a little looking. Criticism and gossip. Yes. Yeah. That's personal, isn't it? That criticism and gossip. I'm one, I'll just say it very simply, I'm one that I think criticism is a negative thing. I don't care what you call it. You know, constructive criticism is a myth. There's no such thing. You know, criticism is criticism. You don't need to dignify it with some softening word. It's criticism. And I find it to have very little value. Gossip, just another extension of that, I really believe that gossip is a dangerous thing. It's a dangerous thing. It can be a deadly thing. And particularly in our society where trust is critically important. Trust is critically important. I don't think we can overestimate how important it is that we not get casual about what we do in our meetings and fail to honor the trust that's implied in that. When we get to a place that we can't comfortably open up and share intimate personal stuff, I think we've got real trouble with that. And so any kind of a conversation about somebody who's not present is high risk. It's high risk. And I don't think I do that. I don't think I do. If I do, it's totally unconscious. I don't listen to it. I don't spread it, and I don't listen to it. Because if I listen to it, I'm part of it. I had a guy in my home group the other day that flagged me down when I was walking by. He told me he was somewhere, and he said, I saw some old buddies. They said, you know what one of those guys said about you? And I said, no. He said, you want to know? And I said, no. And he said, you mean you don't want to know what somebody said? I said, listen, I would not waste 10 seconds of my time on some idiotic thing that somebody said in some... No, I have no interest. I got more important things to do. I was on the way to go talk to a newcomer. I'm going to sit there and listen to that. Whatever it was. Might have said, Iverson's gaining weight. I don't care what it was. It didn't make any difference. It was totally useless information. And so, I've got no interest. I've seen real damage done, and you probably have too. I mean, real danger, dangerous stuff done. And this is not a place where we ought to do that, I don't believe. Negative thinking, it's hard not to do it. But negative thinking, if you talk about what's going to pull down the morale, what's going to pull down emotional sobriety, what's going to pull down my zest for what I do in this program. And negative thinking is a big downer. They don't do it right. Now, I know you guys didn't observe anything. We came over from Scotland about how we do our meetings. But if we'd let you, you'd have probably said, now here's how we do it in Dundee, you know. I think probably the most unpopular thing you can offer in any town that you move into is how we did it where I came from. No market for that whatsoever that I've ever found. It'll do it right. Well, we got a 1,000 war stories about that. I tell you one thing that I've just, one bottom liner on that, I'll tell you one thing I've learned. We are the most difficult people on earth to deal with as far as change is concerned. We don't even like change when it's our idea. And you let somebody come in and try to say, now here's what we're going to do. Forget it. Forget it. I joined a group one time and I didn't utter the mission, but my mission was to make an AA group out of that. 5 years later, I left in total defeat. These guys, if people develop what fits them, not me, you know. And so, anyway, a lot of grief and a little thing like that. Self-pity. I talk about eating your lunch. Yeah, self-pity. Don't even need to say a thing, because that absolutely, poor old me, yeah. Depending on people versus higher power, sort of like the thing I started out with, expectation, depending on people rather than higher power. It's like what I said about that flock of people I was sponsoring in that city who all got drunk when I left. That's depending on people, you know, rather than higher power. And my job is sort of help people get that perspective if I can. Erratic or no step work is it goes without saying. But erratic is about as bad as none. I'll give you one example of that. A few years back, we were talking about somebody supported a meeting. A few years back, I got really sick of, we're going to have to take a break. I'm the world's worst break person. I'll finish this and then we'll take that, eight, 10 minutes. But I just finished this thing a few years back. I really got, like many of you probably have, I really got sick of the revolving door of AA. And it looked to me like we had floods of people coming in and more going out. And I got so sick of that, so sick about that, that I was really looking for something that might be a better deal. You know, and over the years, I mean, I've done all kind of stuff with steps. I've done it Marine Corps style of taking folks through, you know, bang, 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 you know, all that kind of stuff. But and everything worked a little bit. I've never seen anything didn't work for somebody. And nothing that would work for everybody. But I found a thing. A buddy of mine was doing something and he showed me what it was. And it sort of made sense. It rung a bell. And what he was talking about was taking people through the book, you know, taking people through the program using the book. And, really what rung a bell with me was rather than reading the book and trying to translate it into my understanding, The operative terms was always, how do you relate or how do you identify? Never, what do you think? Never. Because the whole purpose was to make the story of recovery that's laid out in the book my story of recovery. Well, that made sense to me immediately. I'd never been to a thing like that, but I said, well, I'm going to try that. So I told some folks I sponsored, I said, we'll try this thing here. If anybody wants to get in on it, then bring anybody you want to. And, that sort of thing, that's a special purpose kind of a deal. So we did it not as part of a group, just a bunch of people wanted to do the book. And I didn't have a clue what I was doing. But we went through it, and sure, if you're in a hurry, you don't want to do it. Because it took a long time. It took a long time. We were close to a year on that first one, I think. And an interesting thing happened. I mentioned a little earlier about half measures, not doing much. What I saw was that of people who went through that entire experience, and I mean the entire experience, even though it's been several years ago, none of them have drunk. None of them have drunk. Now, I'm not a magic bullet type of guy. But I really believe what Kent said it last night, that if I am genuinely doing this work, doing these principles in my life, practicing what that says, there's no room for failure. There's no room for it. And so that erratic kind of work, what we saw was that if, and I'm talking about missing at all. When people miss sessions, it's just like that little thing at the start of chapter 5. Half measures avail us nothing. Not a little bit. Nothing. That's what we saw. We had all success up to this day of the people who made the entire deal. We had one suicide of somebody who didn't. And so it's a pretty serious kind of a thing. And so erratic stuff is really shaky. Back when I went to program, we didn't do stuff like that back then. I did it in an erratic way. That's the only way I knew. And so between 12-step calls, I'm banging away on doing this stuff. But it sure helps when you could go through there and not get into an erratic pattern. I'll spend a little bit more time on this in a minute too, but that's nothing new. I always do stuff like that. Let's go ahead and take a 10, 15 minute break like that, and then we'll come back and wrap up for lunch. The news about the ladies' restroom, when one door closes, another opens, it sounds like. And I tell you, if you want to start having trouble, mess with the women's restroom, you'll have big time trouble. So I hope you had a good relaxing break, and we'll break again for lunch at 12:15. I believe we're going to 12:15. All right, and we will hammer out the burgers then. Fill up just two or three things on that, and then I want to move on into the other thing. I'll just kind of hit these right quick, like the things that sort of undermine and take away and interfere with good sound emotional sobriety. Worry. Yeah, worry. It's a human quality, but it is an absolute killer. Always helps me to remember little cliches, that 98% of the things that I worry about most never happen. So I just try to be about as worry-free as I can get. Because it will eat you alive. The lack of focus. Oh, lack of focus. Yeah, that's what I was having a problem here. I didn't have enough focus to see. Lack of focus of just not keeping my eye on the ball. And, just being focused, paying attention. Just the lady was just explaining to me about a little bit of a hearing impaired problem, explaining why she was looking at me so intently. And I told her I thought it was just because she thought I was just drop dead handsome. And she quickly assured me that was not the case. But that's the way she focuses to hear better. And so I appreciate you telling me that. I wish it had been the other, though, I guess. Discouragement. One thing about our deal, it is important to focus on the good news, because in all reality, we deal with a tremendous amount of bad news. We deal with an awful lot of investment of our hopes for people and see them go down. And that's always a kind of a discouraging thing. So I think it's awfully important for me to keep a positive look on the potential, that everybody who walks into these doors has the same potential that I do for finding a brand new life. And so that's why I always like to look at it that way. And not get caught up in the all too sad statistics. Change of mind, simple little thing. Change of mind. That what we have here is such a fragile thing. When we're on, we get about as tough as they come. But boy, is it ever fragile. Because all I've got to do is just change my mind the least little bit about the value, about the criticality of things I do. And man, I can put it in the dump quickly, very quickly. All I've got to do is just change that mind. And what I've been many, many years building up can be as if it never happened, very quickly. All I have to do is just let go. Don't have to have any traumatic event. It'll just automatically happen if I just shift my thinking just enough to do so. Fear. That's huge. It's always fascinating to me with working with people on inventory with that true macho quality that we always think anger is going to be the biggest list of all. It's always fear, the biggest thing. If I had to rename alcoholism, which is not going to happen, I think it would be self-centered fear. And very, very pervasive thing. Stinking thinking. You don't hear this term much anymore. But stinking thinking. And it can ruin the very best day. Just stinking thinking. Dry drunk, you know, they would call it. One of the little handy cliches that I always like to kind of keep in mind, that when stinking thinking is even approaching, as that there's nothing so bad that a drink won't make it worse. And a simple little thing like that. Sometimes I don't need profound concepts. I need something that cuts right to the chase and says, here's what it's about. And last one, and I think we may visit this a little bit more too, but money, property, and prestige. I list them all together, and you're familiar with the language in the sixth tradition that we often think of that in terms of organizational thinking, but I think it's awfully important in terms of the stability and the steadiness and the wellness of sobriety is that I not get caught up in money, property, and prestige. I'm a very fortunate guy in the... Somebody stole my water. Oh, here it is. I'm always a little paranoid around alcoholics. So my first thought's always, somebody stole it. I was really blessed that it's a strange blessing, but I haven't had a money problem since the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been broke, but I've never had a money problem. I've had a no money problem a few times, but there's a big difference. I've never had a money problem, and it's a strange blessing, but that there was a period of my life when I had no income that was legal, and very little it was illegal, because I was so drunk I couldn't even steal. But being in that condition is an awfully good conditioner to how to deal with nothing. That you really, what I learned is that I just really don't have to have stuff. It's not all that important. And so I don't recommend that as a financial management course, but it does an awful lot. I'm just absolutely amazed that it just have been broke a lot of times, but no money problem. Because money can absolutely consume, can't it? Yeah, if you're morbidly concerned about too little, or probably even more dangerously, too much. Too much. When I've got enough that it starts to own me, and my money becomes who I am, or property, you know, that I've got to have the swankiest, the newest, the biggest, you know, whatever, prestige. You know, somebody will talk about the danger, like if you do a lot of speaking around the country. I've had a lot of people say, doesn't that give you an ego problem or something, doing that so much? And I swear to God, that's a form. How could you, it's always been for me, how would you become a big shot in an anonymous organization? just a contradiction in terms, you know, that. But that thing of prestige, that who I am, is important. You know, it was a funny thing. We were trying to set up some stuff you have to do with the federal government for having to do with a conference to set up some kind of a tax free or something, some federal hopscotch. So since I didn't know much about it, they asked me to handle it. And so I started doing it, and the correspondents came to, and I'm about as anonymous as Hurricane, but the mail was coming to my house, full name, Alcoholics Anonymous, my address. Well, I mean, I'm not overly concerned about that, except that it just happens to violate totally the whole principle of anonymity. And so I said, I'm going to call. So I called up. And so getting into a federal bureaucracy and getting into a meaningful conversation is a challenge. And so I finally got a lady on the phone, and I told her, I said, all I want to do is just get the address changed, because what we've got down there is not appropriate. And she looked at it, she said, well, what's wrong with it? I said, well, that anonymous means what it says, you know, that means don't tell nobody, you know. And she said, why? So I started explaining, and she said, kind of a stock thing you hear, she says, well, don't you think there'd be a good side to that, people would know that their neighbor was in Alcoholics Anonymous, that it might attract more people to the program? And I said, did you ever think of how many it might drive away? She said, oh, no, you're not that kind of guy. But see, prestige, and I have worked with people who went through this phase of believing that if they were less careful with their identity, that it would help more people come to Alcoholics Anonymous. It happens a lot of times with, like, celebrities, where they really feel that if they become public, that it will encourage others to come. And so, you know, when you get caught up in that kind of prestige thinking, that dangerous thing, you know, that my emotional sobriety is going to be a little shaky at best. Well, what we've just done is taken a look at just 27 things. You could probably come up with another list of 27 or 47. But they're just things that come to me when I think about things that impact negatively on my recovery, you know, that emotional recovery. And very frankly, I think that good, sound recovery comes in putting these principles to work. I have just sort of a personal commitment that I work on no problems. I really don't. In terms of my own personal comfort, my own level of sobriety and comfort with my sobriety, I absolutely work on no problems. And I haven't for a long, long time. Because what I find literally, and it's almost a cliche to say this, but I literally mean this, I find that when I focus on problems and try to work on them, they become worse. They truly become worse. What I do is stir them up and agitate them and make them worse. So I'm not working on relationships, job, money, citizenship, nothing. I'm not working on a single problem. What I do is practice these principles as a way of life. Kent said it well last night, and in that little preface to the 12 and 12, it says in loose presentation of it that our steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature. It tells us what they are, you know, what our tools are. They're a group of spiritual principles. And then I think very, very important wording, which if practiced as a way of life, not worked or studied or read or written, if practiced as a way of life. Just some of the stuff we were talking about. If these principles don't show up in my life, where are the principles? If practice is a way of life. We'll do, no number on it said, but what will happen if I do that? It will expel my obsession to drink. It'll push it away. It'll push it away. It'll absolutely do that. It will expel that obsession to drink and enable the sufferer, me, to become happily and usefully whole. And that is a huge statement. And that is a very accurate statement, that if I practice these principles as a way of life, all of those things have happened for me. I haven't had an obsession to drink for, something like 43 years since the last time I had an obsession to drink. Now, I'm not cocky enough to think that those things are history. They've been history for a long time. But I would not be surprised if I had one in Lake Milton, Ohio. But I'll guarantee you I would not be unprepared either. Yeah. Yeah, because what I found is that the obsession is removed, but not too far. Old Ron's sitting on mine right now. He's just holding it for me in case. Because all I have to do to get that to revisit is what? Just stop the practice of these principles in my affairs. And I don't have to get any sort of a challenging situation or tragedy or any of that. You know, all I have to do is let down on what makes me at peace and that makes that obsession go into neutral. And then will enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. I want to visit, now we've talked about problems. And so I want to shift in, and we'll just sort of warm up with it a little bit. I want to shift into the program of recovery and look at how it, not, you know, like directly tied to one of those things, but those principles in all of my affairs are what produces, what do you call it, emotional sobriety. So I want to take a look at those things with you. In terms of how that works, I want to particularly move into the area that Bill was talking about in that article, where the real solution to this stuff is not in studying it and examining it and working on it, but in getting caught up in being an active agent of service to other alcoholics. So I want to lead into that and wind up somewhere in there. So we'll just get going with it a little bit. And I won't run through the steps willy-nilly, but visit with them enough to sort of see that this is what my solution is. My way of life is what makes it happen for me. When I came in the program, I truly did not believe I was alcoholic. Really didn't. I was 24 years old, and in 1957, 24-year-olds were not flowing off the production line very, very quickly. In fact, none that I saw. And I was in AA for several years before I ever met anybody my age. I never went to a meeting. I wasn't the youngest guy there. And I got so darn tired of people patting me on the head and telling me how lucky I was that to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I tell you, when you're 24 years old, it is awfully hard to convince a guy that he is so fortunate to be in something called Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of geriatric cases. I remember one time a guy, it was one fellow in particular, he was a really nice man. And he was as sincere as could be, and he was just oohing and aahing about how fortunate I was to be in AA. And he said, "Do you realize that at your age, you could realistically look forward to 50 years of sobriety?" Now he made that sound like you could win the lottery or something, you know. And he just looked like that was the most rapturous thought known to man. But while he was oohing and aahing, I was saying to myself, my God, what if it works? Man, I'm going to get caught up in this thing and there's no escape. I'll be here forever. And I tell you, that did not seem like a happy thought at that point. But that was a kind of an awkward period. I didn't really believe it, that I was alcoholic. I knew and I agreed that alcohol had caused a lot of problems in my life. Now, that was obvious. The guy that, I know a lot of people in this room, I think a lot of you know that I started AA in a correctional institution. I was locked up in a maximum custody penitentiary. And what led me into AA was a guy just suggested to me that there was a group there and thought it would be helpful to go. And I didn't really want to join AA. I'd never heard of it. I didn't have a clue what it was. AA was not well known back then. We had 125,000 members. I didn't know I was going to be number 125,001. But this guy suggested to me, and I walked into the meeting, and I could listen to what was going on. And it's a strange thing about listening to somebody tell their story. When I heard that, what it sounded to me like they were saying was that they were alcoholic because when they drank, they got in trouble. Well, my God, if that's what alcoholism is, I'd had that all of my life because I've been in trouble all of my life and never sober. I never got into any trouble. I never went to jail sober in my life. Never wrecked a car sober. I woke up one time in a burning car, mine, and policeman was trying to break in the window to get me out, and I thought he was trying to arrest me, so I'm pushing back. There were a few little minor peccadillos like that, but I woke up one time married to a lady I didn't even know. I mean, at all. So when they talked about, alcohol causing trouble, I said, yeah, I've had a little of that and all of my life. But there's a big difference between acknowledgement or pleading guilty is about what I was doing. I said, yeah, I did that too. But that doesn't mean a lot, what it did mean was that I had made the rite of passage. And I am so grateful that in our program, we do not have stringent entry requirements. We don't read resumes. We're not overly interested in pedigree. What we're interested in is, that's the strangest fellowship in the world. It's the only place I know where the worse your history, the better your welcome. You come in here real nice and foo-foo and all that kind of stuff. People look at you funny. Say, why are you here? You come in here and say, well, I just killed my mother-in-law or something like that. Yeah, come on in, man. Come on in. We're a strange bunch. And so when I listened to folk telling that stuff, I said, yeah, man, I've done some of that. But that wasn't a bit more of admitting that I was alcoholic. It was just sort of saying, yeah, I did all that myself. I'm guilty of it. Back then, alcoholism was far from being acknowledged as an illness, as it pretty much is today. It was anything but. Alcoholism was very much a moral issue. It was a moral issue with me. When I first heard people talking about alcoholism being an illness in AA, I found it a fairly embarrassing concept. I thought, what on earth is an illness about getting drunk? I mean, that made no sense to me. It was a moral thing. I thought the reason that I got so much trouble is that I was just no good. I was just a kind of a worthless kind of guy who had no discipline or responsibility. That's truly what I believe. But that grudging acknowledgement was enough to keep me here, eh? Now, I really love the way we approach it. Our book says that just a willingness to believe is enough to get going. Thank God for that. Thank God for those entry requirements that leave the door very wide for folk coming in. And that'll narrow as time goes by. But that was tremendously important to me. And so it was enough to keep me going. Life was unmanageable. Again, just very, very primitive terms. Yeah, I'm in a cage. You know, how much more unmanageable could it get? I mean, that's tantamount to proof positive. You know what? You wouldn't be in this cage if your life was in good order. You know, and so, but that is just sort of an acknowledgement. But again, it steadied me there. And so, now I knew I was kind of a worthless dude, and that I don't know. I guess something told me that there might be something here for me. I'll tell you one thing that was powerfully persuasive to me that and remained important to me for many, many years. The guy who spoke at my first meeting was a guy in a neighboring state just north of here, a guy up in Michigan. That's where I was. And the man who spoke at my first meeting later became my sponsor. Was as different from me as any human I have ever met. I mean, I've never met a guy more different. But he was a guy that was imbued with the spirit of enthusiasm second to none. Like Kent. When Kent talks, he can't contain himself. You know, he just absolutely has got to come on out. And that's the way the guy was who spoke at my first meeting. And I know without any question, that's the only thing that brought me back to my second meeting. It wasn't just the compelling evidence of, you know, the trouble and all that. What brought me back was that spirit that was conveyed by that guy. And so I found myself sitting back in AA. And so for a little while, that's what it was. That group at that institution in Michigan was an excellent AA group. Yeah. I'm really sad to say it, but I mean, I travel extensively. But I would rate the group that I went into in a maximum custody penitentiary more solid, more effective than 90% of the groups that I visit today in this country. It was a good, sound, solid group. It understood the fifth tradition, did a marvelous job of introducing guys like me to this design for living that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. That was critically important for me, to get that kind of beginning in a good, solid, purposeful group. And I'll be ever grateful for that. And so I started getting in. I started getting introduced a little bit. I am so grateful for how we go about dealing with people like me. Yeah, I was a guy that was, I'd call myself an atheist when I got here. I don't think I really was a true committed atheist. I just thought that was a little more sophisticated term than confused, you know. And so, whatever it was, where there should have been a spiritual core, there was nothing. There was nothing. There was a cold, if there was any feeling, it was more anger than nothing where any sort of values could be formed or any kind of belief system. Nothing like that. It was just totally out of the deal. And so, we call this a spiritual program, but I tell you what, it sounds awfully religious to a guy of my frame of mind. And when I walked into my first meeting, the first thing we did was pray. It's the same prayer we did here today. Hadn't changed a lick. And while they were praying, I was saying to myself, I knew it. I knew it. I knew they were going to be.